Welcome to Mind Food Radio, Smart Thinking with Michael McHugh and Ben Starr.
And here we are for another fabulous episode of Mind Food Radio, Smart Thinking. Hello, Michael.
Hello. Now, come on, tell me, how was that trip to Rome?
I loved Italy. Rome was fantastic, yes. And I spent a bit of time with Princess Electra Marconi. Her father invented radio broadcasting.
Wow, get you. Now, I know you're going to do a story for us.
I am indeed. Looking forward to it.
I know, it'll be great. I went to Marlborough.
I saw that.
Exactly.
How was that?
Look, it was fantastic. It's such a beautiful part of New Zealand.
Yes.
Probably isn't quite
Rome. I thought
it
was a cigarette to begin with, but no, yes. I saw that shot of you outside the aircraft.
But our very first guest is Sue Williams, the author of Welcome to the Outback.
Oh, she's got a colourful outback and outlook on life, hasn't she?
She sure does.
And of course, a whole lot of other swag of interviews coming up today on Mind Food Radio's Smart Thinking. Well, Michael, you've lined up a very special interview this time.
We have. Well, as you know, Michelle and I travelled in a car.
Yes.
From Adelaide all the way to Uluru.
You had a great time.
We had a fantastic time. I keep thinking about that. It was a very special journey. And on that journey, we met an author called Sue Williams. And she, for most of our listeners, probably know her as the author of Women of the Outback and the Outback Spirit. But her new book, Welcome to the Outback, is an extraordinary adventure across Australia. Welcome to the show, Sue.
Oh, thank you very much.
That was a great trip we all went on, wasn't it, though?
Oh, it sure was. It was extremely memorable.
It was, my first, I guess, gallivanting across the outback. But for you, I guess you're used to doing all that research and coming across a range of different characters.
Absolutely. But I think it's just wonderful to see sort of city people going into the outback for the first time and really opening their eyes to what's out there, because I think a lot of us don't really realise what's out there. And I think many of us don't even ever venture beyond the cities. There's been new research out saying that 1 in 4 Australians never go beyond a city, which is a shame because there's so much out there to see.
What do you like about the outback?
Oh, well, when I started going to the outback, because I'm such a city person, I really didn't like it very much at all. All I could see was dust and dirt and flies and snakes and kind of nothing there, really. No people and just lots and lots of space. Mm. But the more time I spent there and the more I saw and the more people I met, the more I actually started to really fall in love with it, because there are some such colourful people out there, really eccentric characters, some amazing landscapes, just the incredible red of the deserts, of the earth, the amazing big blue skies.
Now, travelling across Australia, though, you didn't just take a car, you know, you travelled by bus and train and camper van and
I even heard goat.
Tell us about that.
Well, Barcaldine in outback Queensland is very famous, well, kind of a bit famous for its outback goat races. They happen once a year, and I went along to the goat races. And usually it's children in little carriers that ride behind the goats, but they actually allowed me to have a go as well. And previously I'd just been on a cattle drove and riding horses with lots of cattle. So actually riding a little cart behind this much smaller goat was much more relaxing.
It's extraordinary what you write about in terms of getting into a boxing ring. Tell us about that, because
I called Fred Brophy, who runs the last boxing tent in Australia. He works in Outback Queensland. He owns a couple of pubs there. And he just does 6 dates a year now. He takes his Outback boxing tent to Birdsville and to Mount Isa and a couple of other places. And that's the last place where you can actually pay to fight one of his professional fighters. And I just thought he'd be really interesting to interview, and it'd be interesting to go up and watch some of these fighters fight. And then I phoned Fred and said I was coming up, and then before I knew it, on the phone, I actually said to him, "And yes, of course I'd like a fight." And I hadn't really realised I said it out loud, but immediately he said, no, I'm sure you're not really a fighter, and how old are you? And I said my age. He said, no, you're much too young. We like our fighters to be under 30, really. But the more he insisted that I shouldn't fight, the more I insisted that I certainly should. And so for the next 2 weeks, I went to the gym every day to try and get really fit. It was just like a bit of a game, really. But at the point that I was taken into the boxing tent and I had to sit on the mat, and you've got 200 people around you just screaming for blood, and then you're watching guys just really go for it, and you're watching blood spraying all over the place and spit, and you're hearing the real thud of fist on flesh, and you start thinking, oh my God, what
have I done? How glamorous.
Yes, exactly.
Did you panic at that point?
Yeah. Well, actually, the first time I got really hit very hard, everything went black, and as I fell to the ground, I thought, fantastic, I've obviously been knocked out, this is going to be the end of the match. But unfortunately, suddenly the lights flickered back on, and apparently there'd been a power cut. So they just started all over again.
Oh, wow. So what did you learn about yourself? What did you learn about yourself from that experience?
Well, I learned that I'm actually very stupid and I have no imagination.
Author Sue Williams of the new book Welcome to the Outback, available now at all newsagents. Great to have you on the show, Sue.
Thank you very much.
Mind Food Magazine and Mind Food Radio. Together, smart thinking.
We love prizes. What's in the cupboard today?
We sure do. And one of my favourite movies I have seen over the last year, it's The Woman on the Sixth Floor, and it's a DVD.
Yep.
You can go in the drawer to win one of five copies, valued at $35. It's a really fun film set in 1962 Paris.
Oh, lovely.
And it's where a conservative couple lives are turned upside down by Spanish maids who live upstairs. It's fantastic. I love that movie.
So to find out more details, jump onto mindfood.com. And also, you can also grab a subscription there. If you're looking for something to give away as well.
That's right. Head to mindfood.com and you can get a subscription to Mind Food Magazine.
Well, Michael, we are complicated things, us humans, aren't we?
We sure are.
The longest journey in life is life itself, I think.
It is, and it's all about finding the truth self. And on today's show, we've got author Amanda Stewart. Amanda has written a very interesting book, The Longest Journey, and really draws on, I guess, her 13 years of experience with different patients and stuff. And it's about confronting things in life. So it might be physical, sexual or emotional abuse, alcoholism, absent parenting, bullying, sibling rivalry. And it's all about how we survived.
Amanda must have a thick skin to be able to listen to all these things. Amanda, did you always want to help people?
Look, looking back, I think I did. If I look back at my career, I worked in a children's library for a long time. Then I became a teacher, and then I became a counsellor. So I think I was always trying to do that. And, of course, it links to my own childhood, where I looked after a younger brother and sister when my own mother really wasn't coping very well. So I think I learned to do it very early on.
Now, this book will be quite confronting for some people because it's a bit of a warts and all, isn't it, in and around certain areas?
Look, it is, but I think that the first book I wrote was a tame book, and I wrote it very quickly, and then I looked at it and I thought, I don't know why I've written this book. It's too tame. I'm not really saying it like it is. I'm not really talking about the heart of some of these problems and the depths of some of these problems. Through my work, I discovered that if you allow people to get to that pain, they will heal. So what happened was, after about a two-year break of doing nothing, I looked at it again. Luckily, I still had the same computer. I hadn't lost the whole thing. And I thought, right, I have to rewrite the first half. And I have to address things like a parent's suicide, abusive treatment in childhood, sexual abuse, which you can't get hardly any publisher will touch that because it's a very taboo topic still. And yet the statistics tell us one in five children is abused. And those kids, you know, 93%, I think, the child knows the perpetrator or the family knows the perpetrator. So they're pretty, they're terrible statistics, and that's our society now.
There's a great case study in the book, Peeling Back the Layers. I guess, as a therapist, do you do that a lot with your clients in terms
absolutely.
Of...
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I feel my job is to find out what's underneath. Like, I think the case study you refer to is a girl who came, she was so anxious, probably for the first, I would say 6 months, there was so much anxiety that, you know, she was even anxious about things that weren't going to happen or were very unlikely to happen, such as the washing machine might overflow. That was one of hers. And so we had to work on the anxiety to get to what lay underneath. And the biggest thing that lay underneath was her mother had died of an overdose when she was 11. But we couldn't talk about her mother for a very long time. She just said to me, I cannot talk about her. I can't mention her. And this girl, who now doesn't mind at all if it's discussed, but she'd actually created an alternative mother. If anybody mentioned mothers and fathers, she could talk about somebody who was not her real mother or her stepmother. What happens is they try to find a way of dealing with that. So it's like they add the layers of protection and they hide their true feelings because they don't want to say how they really feel. With men, I think, you know, I realized I needed to work with men because they were half the equation and they don't like coming to therapy. Men don't like to say there's anything wrong with my head. It's okay if it's their arm or their leg or their foot. But men don't like to say there's something wrong with my head or my emotions. But when they do come, you find that a lot of the men are suffering terribly because they're trying to be manly and strong, but they don't quite know how to go about being who they are.
Well, as you say here, the only way to heal ourselves and our lives is to confront the hurts of the past head on. The book's called The Longest Journey, Finding the True Self. And Amanda Stewart, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks very much indeed.
This is Mind Food Radio, smart thinking.
Okay, I'd like to welcome Roz Moriarty to the show. She works with an Indigenous art and design group and has won an award in the Australian 2012 Year of Reading campaign with the work she's done on the Nangala project. Welcome to the show, Roz.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
Now, this is a non-profit initiative, isn't it, to relieve poverty and disadvantage, I guess, amongst the Australian Indigenous children and their families.
It is. The book that you referred to is called Listening to Country, and it was published by Allen and Unwin a couple of years ago and is now part of the Year of Reading this year, 2012. And one of the reasons for publishing was to take the Australian reader deep inside traditional Aboriginal Australia, which wasn't something that people generally in Australia have the opportunity to experience. So that was possible because my husband John is Aboriginal from the Gulf of Carpentaria, really, really remote. Mm. And as part of that process of writing a couple of kids' books more recently, we've set up the Nangala Project, which, as you say, aims to alleviate disadvantage in remote communities. So in remote communities, the disadvantage is often very extreme, more so than we realise as Australians living lives predominantly in the city.
Mm. Now, you're preparing under 5-year-olds, aren't you, for literacy and numeracy, and I guess offering them a better chance of reaching, basic Australian educational benchmarks.
Yeah, so one part of the Nangala Project is an initiative called Indie Kindy, which is pre-literacy development for under 5s. And the statistics show us that 2/3 of Aboriginal 8-year-olds throughout Australia are not meeting benchmarks for Australian kids in reading, writing and counting. So we're pitching to the youngest of the age group, believing that if you can help parents prepare their own children better to school, then they'll have a greater chance of being retained at school and succeeding early at school. And it's pretty tough. If children don't succeed early on at school, it's quite tough to keep their interest, and especially in remote communities where there are all sorts of other social issues happening. So that's what our focus is, to try to have our local staff, so it's all about local sustainability, to have our local staff, local mums themselves, prepare the local parents in the community to help their own children get ready for school.
Now, you're also using football and soccer, aren't you, to kind of improve, I guess, school attendance with the under 6, 8 and 10-year-old boys and girls. Tell us a little bit about that.
We are. So another part of the Nangala Project is John Moriarty football. And my husband, John Moriarty, was the first Aboriginal player selected for the Socceroos a long time back. And his initiative that we're developing through Nangala is to prepare under 6, 8s and 10s, as you say, boys and girls, with world-class soccer training. So we've got terrific coaches in there, we've got local coaches, we've got teenagers in the community being prepared as accredited coaches to take a leadership role with the younger kids from the town.
It really is smart thinking, and that's what Mind Food's all about. I also want to talk to you a little bit about the Bungee Travel, which is to mobilise a travel and corporate volunteer workforce to really help deliver those projects.
The goal of Bungee Travel is really to help us mobilise a workforce to help us deliver these not-for-profit projects, so the literacy for the under-5s, the football for the under-10s, and also to give people, both international travellers as well as Australians, the chance to go and volunteer for a week or so in an Aboriginal community. So they'll help us with the literacy in the mornings, they'll help us with the football in the afternoons, with the local staff, local coaches, local kids, 80 kids on the oval 3 times a week, 70 kids now registered under 5 in the reading. Right. And then on the weekend, they'll go with a local family employed by the project to take them out on a dreaming weekend. So they'll go to a dreaming site, they'll hear the stories.
Thank you for being on today's show, Roz. It's a wonderful thing that you're doing there.
Thank you very much. It's really lovely to talk with you, and I love you, Mag. It's great.
Oh, good on you.
Mind Food Radio, smart thinking with Michael McHugh and Ben Starr.
Well, Michael, the theme of love and loss, rejection, self-doubt, and a longing for spiritual meaning, they're all things that we talk about quite regularly here on the program.
We do, and we have on the show today the author of a new book, All of It, A Memoir of Love, Fear and Art, Bev Asbert. Welcome to the show, Bev.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, you're an author of actually more than 14 books that have sold over 500,000 copies in Australia. That's pretty good.
Not bad, is it?
It is indeed. And your latest book, you've also done the beautiful illustration on the cover.
Yes, I'm a painter as well.
Now, you've helped thousands of people, I guess, reclaim their lives from crippling anxiety and depression. And in this book, you reveal, I guess, that deep spirit that lies beneath, you know, your books that are fairly simple. Tell us a little bit about this book.
Well, this book's an entirely different kettle of fish because it is written in a narrative style to start with, whereas the other books are very much how-to books, very simple to deconstruct the messages about, you know, getting your thinking right and so on. So they've been very much a self-help aid, whereas this is very much my own personal story and my own journey through, into and out of very severe anxiety and depression.
It must be very confronting, though, when you're sitting there writing about yourself, when a lot of people would say, but you're so successful.
Yeah, I know. Although it's interesting that a lot of people with anxiety are successful people because they're very driven, and there's that type A personality that goes with it. But the downside of that, of course, is that we doubt ourselves tremendously, so we have to do more and more and more.
But is doing more a way of running away from the feelings?
Not so much in my case. I think perhaps in some people's case, although it is, if my focus is on my work, then it's not on myself as much. But I think for me, there was really a driving force about being appreciated, about being special in some way, standing out, not being invisible. I think I was actually quite frightened of disappearing, and that was one of the key elements from very early in my life.
Can you tell us maybe what some of your panic attacks were around and what you did to try and fix it?
Pretty full on. My heart rate sat pretty well constantly around 120, 130 beats a minute. And it was often even higher than that if I was actually having a panic attack. And I was getting 4 hours sleep. I was wrenched awake with the anxiety. It was quite extreme. In fact, in the book it mentions a comment by a psychologist who saw me in those early stages, who described me as one of the most frightened people she'd seen.
Mm. But as a counsellor who helps people, it must be hard to go to a psychologist. Like, it must be a very interesting experience.
Yeah, some of the most neurotic of us are those who help others. But I really think that we're working our way through something all our lives. So it's not about arriving at a destination and having it all sorted out. And there's always someone a little further down the road than you are.
Now, for people listening today, what are three tips that, you know, perhaps someone is suffering anxiety or a level of depression out there? What are just three really simple ideas or tips to help them through a day?
Look, I know it sounds as though I'm trivialising it, but I'm not, but I am. What I'm saying is, don't take it so damn seriously.
Yeah.
It's just a set of symptoms. It's just a set of physical symptoms, really. And if you're not adding World War III in your mind, then it remains just things that are a little bit out of balance. And learn to be much kinder to yourself. You know, talk softly to yourself, because if you're already scared, it's not going to be helpful to tell yourself horror stories on top of that.
Yeah.
And thirdly, yes, read my books, because they take you through the whole thing.
Bev, thank you very much for being on today's show. For more information, go to mindfood.com. And all the best. I look forward to your next book, which I'm sure there will be.
Thank you very much for having me today.
Well, we do like the odd drop of wine here and there.
We do, and this is an extraordinary story because you've obviously had a few Lindemans.
I love Lindemann wines. Celebrating 100 years.
I know, like I didn't think there was a winery around that.
Off to the cellar door we go.
Exactly. So I'd like to welcome to the show the cellar door manager, Damien. How are you, Damien?
Yeah, good, thanks.
Now, you work in a beautiful place in Australia, the Hunter Valley. That must be pretty tough going to work every day.
It is, mate. Very tough. Nice part of the world.
It sure is. Now, tell us a little bit about how Lindemann started. There was a doctor, wasn't there? A Dr. Lindemann's.
Yeah, Dr. Henry John Lindemann founded the business in 1843. He was a British naval surgeon, and basically came on on the boat up to a place called Cawarra, or a property called Cawarra, which is near Gresford. And Lindemann started in 1843.
It's amazing when you think about how wine is created. What's the difference between back then and now?
And look, there's a lot of things that have changed, obviously, over the times. I mean, you see a lot of footage about Lindemann's in the early days, you know, even hand harvesting. Now we're machine harvesting. You know, you're talking about people's palates changing in the winemaking process. So everything from basically the grape and our viticulture now is a lot better than what it was back there, and gives us more opportunities to make more consistent wines.
Has the philosophy changed, though, you know, over the years, do you think?
No, look, the philosophy of Lindemann's is basically the one purpose of wine is to bring happiness, and, you know, whether it be, you know, 1843 or today, you know, that's Lindemann's philosophy, is to make sure that people are enjoying our products.
Now, there was also a cafe, though, wasn't there? Didn't he create a cafe?
Well, what's happened is Lindemann's Benin in the Hunter has been operating now. They moved on site in 1912 and been operating now 100 years on this property. So to basically celebrate that, we've actually opened a cafe from the birth year called Cafe 1843, which is a cafe all around local produce. And there's a local chef here, Craig Parkinson, who's designed the menu with produce, you know, within and around the district, to keep it quite focused.
How does it work from your point of view? You know, a wine like Riesling that, you know, at the moment, I guess, people are really enjoying and coming back to, but over the years, you know, Riesling hasn't perhaps been as fashionable. For you guys that have planted a lot of Riesling, how does that work? Like, what do you do with all that wine?
Yeah, look, we you know, at the moment we've just created a new wine, which is called Eliza's Ten. Now, part of that Lindemann story and the 100-year celebration is the fact that Lindemann's wife, Eliza, had five sons and five daughters, and what we've done is we've released this new range of wines that's exclusive to the Cellar Door, and we're using varieties like that, Riesling and Pinot Noir, and you know, wines that are starting to come back into fashion from around the country. You know, these wines are moving into more of a better for you icon, and you know, 25% lighter in alcohol and those things, so that, you know, we can actually provide something that can be consumed all times, you know, not producing a lot of high alcohol wines that are mostly used around dinner, so that people can enjoy them at cafes for lunch.
Well, look, thanks very much for joining us today on the program. Very, very interesting topic, and we wish you all the best of luck, eh?
Thank you.
Thanks, Damien.
Very interesting, Michael, isn't it? All that wine region stuff.
Well, I love a heritage story because I think for a brand like that, and it was great the way he created that.
Yeah.
But did he say five wives and five daughters?
Yeah, something like that.
Oh, that wine's really healthy.
I was just thinking of a friend of mine who said, oh, I want to move to the country and have my own vineyard. And I thought, it's a lot of work.
It sounds good, but I don't know.
It's a bit like the veggie patch that we're still trying to get going.
Oh, no, that's coming along.
It's coming, is it?
Really well, but it has rained a lot.
Gardening's an interesting area, Michael. Landscaping, design, you love it.
I know you're
trying.
I know indirectly you're actually trying to ask me about the vegetable garden that we are creating.
I know. Well, it's happening. You told me it's happening.
It is happening. I have bought seedlings, but the thing is, we have had so much rain while you've been swanning around in Rome.
I know. It's been very hot there.
Exactly. That we haven't been able to get out and actually garden. That does sound like a big
excuse.
And
I've even bought stuff for you to plant in that garden.
Yeah.
So you've got Matthew on the line.
We have.
From
Matt Leesey, who's the director of Land Art Landscape. Hi, Matt. How are you?
I'm well. How are you both?
Very good. So tell me, in terms of landscape gardening, what are the trends that are coming through at the moment?
It's a bit of a mixed bag at the moment. There is different collections of different things that are appearing in the gardens. There's no real set rules. It seems that we're sort of steering away now from the sort of structured, definitive garden.
And why is that?
More into, I think we, you know, we just probably had it around for about 10 years, and it's a natural progression into something else. There's a lot of more free-flowing, I guess you could say it's almost prettier.
And are you seeing, like, increases of worm farms and compost heaps and things like that? Like, are people really challenging themselves to get out there and sort of use all that stuff?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. There's especially in the inner city, it seems to be popping up a lot. And also in terms of green walls, green roofs, spaces where there were, you always thought there wasn't an opportunity to have a garden. Mm. We're starting to now create gardens in those spaces.
So, what about the aspect that people are putting in herb gardens and gardens, you know, for growing stuff? Are we seeing more of that, or is that just all talk?
No, that's probably pretty much every garden I go to these days, or every consult, the client says, I want somewhere where I can grow some herbs or veggies. And it might not be a big veggie patch. It might just be a nice contemporary bowl or something that can house some herbs. Mm. But everybody puts that on their list.
It's kind of interesting, though, that, in terms of garden media and magazines, garden magazines are declining. And I think we've actually got less garden shows on TV. However, yeah, gardening as an interest is still incredibly popular. You know, if you think of the people you know, and definitely, obviously, in your line of business, Matt, is there a resurgence, do you think, in that backyard and people wanting to get out there and garden?
It's an interesting one. I think there is a lot of, there's a lot of gap in the market in terms of what is on television at the moment.
Yeah.
I think there is still room for television shows that have that before and after factor.
Yeah.
We have some good gardening shows, like Gardening Australia, but it seems like it's almost, it's targeted at an older audience.
Yeah.
So for the young crowd that are getting into it and are interested in it, there's nothing really out there for them to feed off in as far as inspiration goes.
Do you think that's because people think it's too hard?
I think there's a misconception with that, absolutely. But it's the maintenance side of things, I think. People know what they're like. They get into something and then they lose interest.
Mm.
And so what starts off as a beautiful-looking little herb garden or veggie patch soon starts to turn into an area that's just full of weeds or just full of soil.
I can't identify
with that.
Don't even start.
What about art in the garden? You know, like sometimes on those shows you see some art put up and it's really quite hideous. Like anything with mirrors is a bit of a turn off unless it's professionally done.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And mirrors can be used really well in a garden. There's definitely space for mirrors in a lot of gardens as long as you say, they're used correctly.
Finally, three tips to make a great garden. What are they?
Water, fertilizer, and love and care.
Yeah, good advice.
I love that.
You can't get away from those things.
Matthew, thank you for joining us.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
That's really great. Nice to have you on the show. Very interesting stuff, all that art stuff and land and putting it all together.
I just struggle trying to keep up with the weeding and making it look good and get it. And you see, here's the thing with the bulbs. You know, I bought those a couple of weekends ago when I was at the garden centre. I still haven't put them in, but it's been raining every weekend.
Yeah.
And of course, during the week, you get busy with work and, before you know it, it's dark. And
Do you have a lot of grass?
Yeah.
That's hard.
Well, not a lot of grass, but
The grass is another thing that takes up a lot of time.
How would you know? You've got none.
I've got none here, but we used to.
Mind Food Magazine and Mind Food Radio. Together, smart thinking.
Now, on today's program, what can we win, Michael?
Well, today you can win one of five Estee Lauder makeup palettes and fresh plum valued at $100.
Fantastic. How do we win that?
You just go to mindfood.com. Too easy.
Well, architecture is a big thing in school kids and the Museum of Contemporary Art. What's happening over there, Michael?
Well, of course, at the moment, we've got the fantastic Vivid exhibition.
Love
on.
That.
It's just extraordinary. Yeah, yeah. That giant chandelier in the middle. It kind of plays.
Is that an image of you the other night that I saw out there, like across the city?
No, I'm not denying and I'm not saying anything about that. However, what the MCA have done is they have got a whole bunch of different school kids together and a range of designers and sort of taking them into different worlds of design. And we're very lucky to have to the show, Mind Food Show today, Raman Jeromi from the Cox Architecture, and he, of course, is one of their architects. Welcome to the show, Raman.
Good, thank you. How are you, Michael?
Good. Now, tell me, what's your involvement with this?
Well, my involvement was through Vivid Festival, the Light, Music and Ideas one. As part of Vivid Ideas, they ran a workshop, which they call it, with Object Gallery called Design Emergency with the primary schools.
And so is it really sort of teaching kids, I guess, the principles of design?
Yeah, basically it's teaching kids the whole premise of what is design and how can it change the world and how they can actually be exposed to it. So basically they ran this program through the schools and they involved five designers to be part of that process to teach kids the whole process of how you can actually design and how you can get a number of ideas and how you actually realize it.
What about the influence of computers and stuff? Do you find that they were more computer literate than you thought?
I think computers, especially at the end, because we took them through a number of steps. The first bit was discovery, which they did themselves. They found out a problem, what the problem was. Then we asked them to interpret it. And then, you know, then we... So we didn't really use computers then. The technology bit really came at the end where we actually asked them to put a PowerPoint together.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And their thinking, you know, in terms of coming to a solution in and around design, could you see that it was quite different to perhaps your clients and, you know, the adult world?
Yeah, well, I think that the whole premise is that it just basically assumes that a child, I mean, I tend to agree with this, is that the child thinks a lot more creatively and a lot more laterally than an adult. So they just don't have the barriers that we set are around us design thinking as adults or as mature people. So they come up with much more, I think they have an extraordinary ability to think creatively compared to an adult.
When they left, could you see that it was quite a, that you had given them some real tangible results, that they were thinking quite differently in and around solutions when it comes to design?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that was the whole process, and they started, obviously, kids, as you know, probably, and the 10-year-old kids just always want to build something. So they took, my group of kids from Putney School took, they had three models that they took with them. They built them there, and I was just basically trying to, I mean, being an architect, it was very hard for me to stop drawing or because or trying to take over the model making. So
I'm hopeless at drawing.
basically, you're trying to teach the kids how to experiment. I think that's the real key point, that you just don't, I mean, and I think in Australia, that's a big issue for us compared to some Scandinavian countries where design thinking is a big part of their life. What objects, and through Vivid, we're trying to do is, was to teach Australian primary school kids that design can be part of your everyday life.
That's right.
It's not just something that a professional does, it's actually part of your daily life.
And for you in your life, you know, working with a group of architects and clients, did it make you perhaps rethink things as you came back into the workforce?
Well, I think so. I think that the way you think about things is that, as I was saying, that we build barriers around our thinking or our brain, but I think that once you spend time with primary school kids, and because I teach at university as well, it's a very different premise. But when you're actually with school kids, it actually opens your world into innovation and the way that you can question everything. Because we consciously have to ask ourselves to question things. But when you spend time with 10-year-olds, it's just done without effort. Whilst as adults, I think as designers, as professionals, you just can't, you have to force yourself to think outside the box. But I think with when you spend time with kids, it just becomes part of your process.
Hey, Raman, so thank you very much for your time today. That's been very interesting. And I think, you know, going into the mind of children, they just get it right often because they don't have the barriers that I think we all put up. So thank you very much for being
thank
on Mind Food Radio.
Thank you for asking me. Thank you.
This is Mind Food Radio, smart thinking.
Now time on Mind Food Radio, Michael, off to the dietitian's corner of the spectrum.
That's right. And in the latest edition, there's a story there all about emotional eating, you know, at this time of the year, avoiding that winter weight gain. But today we've got on the show Dr. Kate Walsh, a dietitian, and it's all about, I guess, a vegetarian diet. Welcome to the show, Dr. Kate.
Thanks.
Now, you specialise in vegetarian diets, don't you?
I do, yes, that's correct.
So tell us, you know, for those of us who think, you know, a little bit in everything in moderation, why choose a vegetarian diet?
Look, there's sort of an increasing amount of research, I guess, to show that there are a lot of health benefits of eating a vegetarian or just a plant-based diet. So it doesn't necessarily mean that you need to be vegetarian completely. I mean, just adopting, I guess, more plant-based meals and more vegetarian meals can help. But certainly vegetarians, if you look at the research, you know, are less likely to be overweight. They have lower risks of diabetes and heart disease and certain types of cancers. So certainly from a disease risk point of view, which is, you know, in a lot of our population now, is at risk. There are a lot of benefits, it seems, of eating more vegetarian.
Do vegetarians get cravings like, you know, I really want a carrot or, you know, salt, you know, those types of things? I mean, it's an interesting area to be a vegetarian. I don't sort of understand it, but because I had an auntie that used to say to me, what you need is a piece of meat, build your iron up.
Yeah, well, that's, I mean, so we've, you know, we've just actually done a media launch this morning for a publication that's been, we've just published a series of papers which have come out in the medical journal of Australia, I guess, trying to look at, you know, is a vegetarian diet adequate, which it certainly is, and sort of debunking some of those myths. And that's certainly one of the common ones, that you need red meat to get iron. And in fact, most of the iron in our diet, even in non-vegetarians, actually comes more from grain and cereal foods. as well. And certainly you can get enough iron quite easily on a plant-based diet from a range of plant foods. So grains, legumes, tofu, nuts and seed all have, you know, good amounts of iron in there, even if you're not a meat eater.
Mm-hmm.
And in your practice, are you seeing an increase in people with perhaps food allergies or weight gain? Like, what are the major concerns that people are coming to you for?
Yeah, so I think diabetes and you know, weight issues, I guess, are really increasing problems. I mean, that's an area of specialty. I'm also a credentialed diabetes educator, so I see a lot of people with type 2 diabetes and also women with polycystic ovary syndrome, or PCOS,
mm-hmm.
Which the underlying problem is insulin resistance, so they're quite at risk of developing diabetes, but in the short term have other symptoms and can have problems with fertility. And both of those are really increasing problems because, you know, as a population, our lifestyle is becoming more sedentary and we're gaining weight, and that actually predisposes, you know, people who are genetically at risk are more likely to then develop those conditions. So I think they're the biggest things that we're seeing, and certainly diabetes is becoming quite an epidemic.
Do you find that people, when they're getting diagnosed with diabetes, have they been on a meat-based sort of diet for years, or do you get vegetarians coming in with diabetes?
I don't see a lot of vegetarians with diabetes, and we certainly know that the risk is significantly lower. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would say, you know, I mean, typically the people I see would certainly be meat eaters. I mean, obviously varying amounts of meat, but often one of the things, you know, I might talk to them about is actually just reducing the quantity and trying to build in more plant foods, because, certainly there's some evidence that, you know, eating a lot of red meat is associated with diabetes risk for a number of reasons.
Mm. Well, thank you very much for joining us today. It's been nice having you on the program.
Not a problem.
Well, it's really been a bit of a mixed bag of a program today. Everything from psychologists to dietitians.
To the Outback.
To the Outback.
I know.
She's quite colourful, that Sue Williams.
She sure is. And I think the author Amanda Stewart, with that longest journey story, you know, the therapy she has done across the years with all those different clients, it just makes you think, doesn't it?
I wonder if being a counsellor or a therapist like that makes you a stronger person, or you get a very skewed look on life.
Well, she sounded healthy.
Now, of course, next week on the program, a whole lot more.
We sure do. And for more stories and recipes and health tips, go to mindfood.com.
And I'm Ben Starr.
I'm Michael McHugh.
And that's another Mind Food Radio for this week, Smart Thinking.
Mind Food Radio, Smart Thinking, was produced in the studio of Radio Australasia. Produced by Ben Starr and Brian Newington and Patrick Kayrouse. Bogart Torelli speaking.